This morning is the one we read, Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 to 21. So there has been a tense relationship which manifested itself in chapter 9, disappeared from view in chapters 10 and 11, and which now in chapter 12 returns with a vengeance. And it's the tense relationship between Jesus and the Pharisees. The Pharisees were a party within the Jewish people, bound together by their distinctive approach to their religion. And New Testament scholars then like to be very guarded when it comes to the Pharisees. They don't want us to caricature these guys and tar them all with the same brush. And doubtless they have a point, and the situation probably is more nuanced than our pantomime villain approach to the Pharisees often suggests. But nonetheless, in Jesus' interactions with them in Matthew's gospel, they are almost always portrayed negatively, and that's certainly the case here in chapter 12. And so I'm fairly unapologetic about the fact that the Pharisees will not emerge with much credit from our sermon this morning. I think that's okay. I think that's perfectly reasonable. And there are three things then that I particularly want us to notice here. And first of all, Jesus has a significance the Pharisees don't understand. Jesus has a significance the Pharisees don't understand. Some of you may remember Trigger Happy TV, where the comedian Dom Jolly would secretly film himself performing all sorts of pranks out and about among the general public. Most famously, he would be on a train or sitting on a park bench and would start speaking at the top of his voice on this absurdly oversized mobile phone. But another recurring theme in these pranks that he did was him dressing up as and pretending to be a traffic warden. And on one occasion, then, he stands beside this road dressed as a traffic warden, and it's a very busy road. There's a long queue of cars that are at a standstill on this road, and he goes up then to one car in the queue, and he gets the driver to put down the window. Remember, he appears as a traffic warden. He gets the driver to put down the window, and he says in a very authoritative tone of voice, "You can't stop here. This is a no-stopping zone." So the bemused driver patiently explains that he hasn't chosen to stop there. He's stopped there because he's in a queue of traffic. He's in a traffic jam. But Dom Jolly won't have it. "I'm sorry, sir. It's the law. You're not allowed to stop there." And so it goes on for several minutes, and it's very funny. And we might be forgiven for thinking then that the Pharisees are performing a similar prank here in verse 2 of our passage. Jesus' disciples have been walking through some fields on the Sabbath, and being hungry, they've helped themselves to a few ears of corn. And as they're munching away on these ears of corn, they're suddenly confronted by these Pharisees. "You can't do that. You can't pluck ears of corn today. It's the Sabbath. It's the day of rest. It's the day for stopping working out in the fields. You're breaking the law." And of course, it's ridiculous. Just as that no-stopping law didn't really penalise being stuck in a traffic jam, so the Sabbath law didn't really penalise plucking a few ears of corn. Going out with a scythe and harvesting an entire field on the Sabbath, maybe. But not enjoying a little snack as you're walking along. This is a ridiculous accusation. And so, as I say, you might think that these Pharisees, they're a kind of first century version of Trigger Happy TV. This is a prank. The Pharisees are doing a Dom Jolly. They're having a laugh. That's what you might think. But sadly, you'd be wrong. They're not having a laugh. They're actually being deadly serious. They're genuinely accusing these disciples of breaking the Sabbath. But the really interesting thing here is how Jesus responds to the accusation. I mean, he could just have flatly denied then that his disciples were breaking the Sabbath on the grounds that I've just mentioned, on the grounds that the Sabbath law had nothing to do with plucking a few ears of corn to assuage one's hunger. He could have gone down that road and protested his disciples' innocence. But he doesn't. Or at least for the most part he doesn't. He does fleetingly adopt that approach in verse 7, and we'll talk about that later. But for the most part, he does something else. He actually assumes, for the sake of argument, that the Pharisees are right. That his disciples have acted in a way that's contrary to the Sabbath law. Why does he do that? Well, for this reason. If he argues that his disciples have acted within the Sabbath law and defends their conduct in that way, then all he's going to achieve is making a point about the Sabbath law, that the Pharisees are interpreting it and applying it wrongly. That's all he's going to achieve. If, however, he assumes for the sake of argument that they have acted outside the Sabbath law and he still defends their conduct, he can then make a point about his own identity, about who he is, about his true significance and status. And so that's what he does. It's not impeccable Sabbath observance that he defends in his disciples here. It's actually irregular Sabbath bending that he defends in his disciples here. And he can only do that then. He can only defend irregular Sabbath bending by making some pretty big claims about himself. By boldly relating himself, first of all, to David, and then to the temple, and then to God. So first of all, he relates himself to David. This is verses 3 and 4. And in these two verses, he refers to an incident that took place when David was on the run from Saul. And David wasn't on the run by himself. He had men with him. And of course, those men, they needed to be fed. And so in 1 Samuel chapter 21, Ahimelech, the priest, allows David's companions to do this irregular thing and to eat the holy bread from God's house. Lay people weren't supposed to do that, but Ahimelech, he allowed David's companions to do it. Why did Ahimelech allow David's companions to do that? Well, presumably because they were David's companions. As one commentator puts it, Ahimelech's willingness to bend the rules must be related to his assumption that David stood in a category apart from other Israelites. David stood in a category apart from other Israelites. David was the king designate. And he was the king designate not because he happened to be the next in line in some royal family, but he was the king designate by God's special appointment. He was the chosen one. Truly, he stood in a category apart from other Israelites. And Jesus is saying in these verses then, that just as David's companions could act in an irregular way because of their connection to David, so my disciples can act in an irregular way because of their connection to me. In other words, he's claiming to be at least as great as David. Now, we'll see in a minute, that's actually a fairly modest starting point. He's only warming up. He's going to go much further than that in his claims, but that's where he begins. I'm at least as great as David. But then secondly, he relates himself to the temple. And this is verses 5 and 6. And he refers in these verses to the way that priests carry on doing their work on the Sabbath. They don't stop on that day like farmers do and like tradesmen do. So how then is priests' Sabbath work justifiable? Well, because of their connection to the temple. As Don Carson puts it, the temple was greater than the Sabbath. Its activities were non-negotiable. They had to go on 7 days a week, even if that did mean that a class of people in Israel, namely the priests, weren't therefore observing the Sabbath. The priests bent the Sabbath regulations because of their connection to something greater than the Sabbath, the temple. And Jesus is saying in these verses, his disciples can bend the Sabbath regulations because of their connection to something greater than the Sabbath. In fact, he says in verse 6, their connection to something greater than the temple even. Namely, him, Jesus. I mean, this is breathtaking what he claims here. He adds another level to this hierarchy. Yes, you've got the Sabbath. And then above that, you've got the temple. And that's what justified the priests working on the Sabbath. But he's now saying there's another level above the temple. Higher than the temple. And that's me. I'm greater not only than the Sabbath, I'm greater than the temple as well. Greater than the temple. Wow. That's quite a claim. But then he goes further still and he relates himself not only to David, not only to the temple, but he relates himself thirdly to God. And this is verse 8. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And he's saying there then that the whole idea of taking me to task about my disciples bending the Sabbath regulations is just hugely inappropriate. Because the Sabbath is mine at the end of the day. It's my thing. I mean, if you were queuing outside a turnstile at St. James's Park on a Saturday afternoon, and suddenly you spotted Mike Ashley's family, and you noticed that instead of joining the queue at the turnstile, they just went up to this door that said no entry on it. And as they went up to the door was open for them, and they went in, and the door was shut again. If that happened, well, you wouldn't make a big song and dance about that. You wouldn't write an insulting letter to Mike Ashley about how outrageous it was that his family bypassed the queue at the turnstile. Now, you can't take Mike Ashley to task about his family breaking the stadium regulations. The stadium's his. He's Lord of St. James's Park. And Jesus here is making exactly the same point about himself in relation to the Sabbath. But this is the thing. You go back to Exodus 31:13. And Leviticus 19:3 and Leviticus 26:2 and Isaiah 56:4 and numerous verses in Ezekiel 20 and 22. And you find there that someone repeatedly uses the phrase, my Sabbaths, my Sabbaths, my Sabbaths. Who is that someone? Well, it's Yahweh, of course. It's God. And so, in calling himself here in our passage, Lord of the Sabbath, Jesus now is going beyond his other two claims. He's saying not only is he at least as great as David, not only is he greater than the temple, he's saying he's on a par with God himself. God says my Sabbaths. Jesus says I'm Lord of the Sabbath. And so you see what I mean then, that instead of going down the route of my disciples are innocent of your accusation and making the point that the Pharisees have a legalistic view of the Sabbath, instead he goes down this other route. Suppose my disciples are bending the rules. And he makes the point that the Pharisees have failed to understand the significance of him, Jesus Christ. And presumably he does this because, in his view, their failure to understand his true significance is a more fundamental problem than their legalism. I mean, he could easily have won the argument with the Pharisees concerning what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do on the Sabbath. He could have easily shown them that plucking a few ears of corn is not a breaking of Sabbath legislation. He could have blown them out of the water. He could easily have won that argument, and he could have left the Pharisees chastened on that point so that they would never again come out with such a crass accusation. He could have done that. But the Pharisees would still have been blind to the most important truth in the whole world, which is that Jesus Christ is Lord. That he's the preeminent one. That he is God incarnate. That's what they needed to know more than anything. And that's what people in Newcastle today need to know more than anything. Not that homosexuality is wrong. Not that Sunday recreation is problematic. Not that drunkenness is wicked. These things are not the main problems in people's lives any more than legalism was the main problem in the Pharisees' lives. The main problem is that their knees are unbowed before the glory and grandeur of Jesus Christ. That's the main problem. And once their knees are bowed before the glory and grandeur of Jesus Christ, then they will change their lifestyles. But bowing their knees to Jesus Christ is the real necessity. It's the real necessity for you this morning, if you're still coolly disposed toward Jesus. Perhaps you've come to this service this morning for some little moral lesson, because that's what you get in church services, isn't it? You get little moral lessons, and I'm going to give you some tips then about how to be nicer to that grumpy colleague that you have on the next desk at work. Well, I'm not going to do that. I don't have morals to foist on you this morning. I have a person to commend to you this morning. My message this morning isn't sin is bad, although sin is bad. My message is Jesus is Lord. That's what you need to hear. That's what you need to take on board. That Jesus Christ is the most massive person in the whole of reality. And you can no longer pretend that he's not there and live in denial of him. You must worship him. You must cast yourself down at his feet. You must respond in humble submission to his all-surpassing greatness. So that's the first thing we notice in our passage. Jesus has a significance the Pharisees don't understand. But then notice with me secondly, Jesus has a beauty the Pharisees can't match. Jesus has a beauty the Pharisees can't match. So we've said then that mostly in verses 1 to 8, Jesus doesn't go down the route of, this is a ridiculous over-application of the Sabbath law. My disciples are only plucking a few ears of corn, they've done nothing wrong. Mostly he doesn't go down that route, but I did say there's an exception, and that exception is verse 7. And in verse 7, he does refer to the Pharisees condemning the guiltless. So he's talking there about his disciples, and he's saying there that they are guiltless. They haven't broken the Sabbath law. And so there, in verse 7, he is accusing the Pharisees of a ridiculous over-application of the Sabbath regulations. He's addressing there their legalism. But he does so in a very interesting way, because he quotes from the Old Testament, doesn't he? In verse 7, he quotes from Hosea chapter 6, verse 6, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And you might think, well, what on earth has that got to do with it? Well, he seems to be saying that their ridiculous over-application of the Sabbath law isn't simply a quirk. It isn't simply an idiosyncrasy, like my over-application of the instructions on the back of the pizza box, which Hannah laughs at me for, so that if it says 9 minutes, then 9 minutes on the dot, I open the other door and pull out the pizza. No, there's more, something more sinister going on here. Behind their legalism, Jesus is saying there lurks a harshness, a lovelessness, a blithe indifference to people's needs. You see, we're told, aren't we, in verse 1 of our passage, his disciples were hungry and they began to pluck ears of corn and to eat. Not his disciples were bored and began to pluck ears of corn. Not his disciples were greedy and began to pluck ears of corn, even though they just had a meal 10 minutes ago. Not his disciples were feeling mischievous and wanted to annoy the Pharisees and so plucked some ears of corn. No, the disciples were hungry. And it's the same word that we have always in the New Testament for hunger. This was a genuine hunger that the disciples had, and so they plucked these ears of corn. This was a situation of need, I'm saying. And yet the disciples' need simply did not register on the Pharisees' radar. And that issue, of course, becomes more pronounced, doesn't it, as we move into the next section of our passage, verses 9 to 13. And here the setting changes slightly, and we're in the synagogue. And the Pharisees' problem now is not with Jesus' disciples plucking some ears of corn on the Sabbath. Their problem now is Jesus potentially, he hasn't done it yet, but potentially healing a man with a withered hand. And of course, this is even more laughable and ridiculous and absurd than their objection to the plucking of the ears of corn. Because we know, don't we, how Jesus heals people. What's his method? Is it a very strenuous method that involves an awful lot of exertion on Jesus' part? Is he going to have to get out a huge medical box and lie this man down and start operating on him? No, he's going to heal the man with the withered hand by speaking some words. In other words, he won't exert any more energy in healing the man than the Pharisees are exerting in asking the question, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Jesus isn't going to engage in some great labor here on the Sabbath. He's simply going to speak words of healing to this man. And yet again, the Pharisees are up in arms about this. But this time then, Jesus really does go down this route of exposing and challenging their harshness. And he points out, doesn't he, that ironically, these guys, they probably would have at least a sliver of mercy if it was an animal that was in need. But it's not an animal, it's a man, it's a human being in the image of God. It's a man who has been suffering for years, the discomfort and the restriction and all the other problems that came with this affliction he had of a withered hand. And do you see what's going on here then? In verse 7, and then in this next section, verses 9 to 13. Do you see what's going on here? All of this is elaborating what we saw last time. It was 2 weeks ago now, of course, at the end of Matthew chapter 11. And remember there in those famous words at the end of Matthew 11, Jesus talked about a yoke. His yoke, my yoke, he says. And we said then that the yoke to which he's referring, it's the requirements, it's the commands, it's the lifestyle that he sets before his followers. When you're a disciple of Jesus, you live under his requirements, under his commands. You live the lifestyle that he has set out for us. And that's what he's referring to as a yoke. And we talk then, didn't we, about verse 30 of chapter 11, my yoke is easy. And we said that easy is a very unsatisfactory translation there. That it's a much richer Greek word. We identified at least three nuances and said that they're probably all present in Matthew 11, 30. My yoke is good. My commands are good. Nothing perverted or twisted about them. My yoke is kind. The word can mean kind. My commands are for your good. They're health-giving. They're not damaging. They're not detrimental. They do good to those who keep them. And then even beyond that, my yoke is delicious. Remember, I pointed out the word is used in connection with kind of ingestion language, eating and drinking language. It's sweet. My commands are sweet. There's something attractive and delightful about them. And really then, what's happening now in our passage is that that is being clarified and given fuller definition. And it's being clarified and given fuller definition by way of this contrast with the Pharisees. Because of course the Pharisees, they impose a yoke on people. But their yoke isn't good. and kind and delicious. It's harsh and mean-spirited. You might be hungry, but you mustn't pluck any grains, any ears of corn. You might have a withered hand, and you might have had it for years, and you might be in great pain with it, but you mustn't be healed on the Sabbath. That was their yoke. It was a nasty, horrible yoke. Jesus' yoke, on the other hand. It can be summed up as the requirement to show mercy in the language of verse 7. It can be summed up as the requirement to do good in the language of verse 12. Or in the language of the Sermon on the Mount that we considered many months ago now. It can be summed up as do to others what you would wish them to do to you. That's Jesus' yoke. And it's not easy. That's why the translation in chapter 11, verse 30 is unhelpful. It's not easy. We know it's not easy. It's not easy because our fleshly instincts are all opposed to it. And natively, we don't do to others what we would have them do to us. And natively, there's a nastiness and a mean-spiritedness about our hearts. And that's why it's not easy to love others properly and to be merciful and to do good to others. It's certainly not easy. It's hard. But it is attractive. There's something beautiful about it, isn't there? It's not twisted and ugly like the Pharisees' yoke. There's something delightful and lovely about this yoke that Jesus places on his followers. It's not a doddle. It's not a stroll in the park. Because all the flesh within us will resist his yoke and will resist his beautiful commands, his delicious commands. But it is good. It's a good yoke. It's a pure yoke. It's a lovely yoke. Not like this of the Pharisees. And in fact, there's another way in which our passage kind of expands the latter part of chapter 11 there. Remember, we also saw, and I didn't really have time to properly express this 2 weeks ago, but we also saw that Jesus' beautiful yoke that he places on his disciples, it reflects something deeper. It reflects his own beautiful character. That comes out, doesn't it? Verse 29 of chapter 11, I am gentle and lowly in heart. It's because Jesus has this beautiful character that he imposes a good and beautiful yoke on his disciples. And that again comes across in our passage this morning. And it comes across in this quotation from Isaiah. And particularly verses 19 and 20, this lovely description of Jesus. He will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench. The Pharisees, they were in the business of breaking bruised reeds and quenching smoldering wicks. Not Jesus. Jesus, this very different character. Perhaps this morning you need to hear that. Perhaps you're a Christian and you're at a low ebb today. Perhaps you're struggling. Perhaps you're feeling overwhelmed with life. And somewhere along the way you've picked up the impression that Christians aren't like that. You know, Christians are sorted people, permanently with a broad grin painted across their faces. Christians exude this aura of competence and robustness. That's Christians. And because of that, because you've picked up that impression, you imagine that this morning you're at such a low ebb, Jesus is terribly disappointed with you. And if he were here this morning, he would stare at you disapprovingly and he would shake his head and he would give you an earful. I'm saying he wouldn't. He wouldn't. He would put his arm around you. And he would sit you down. And he would encourage you. Because this is Jesus. A bruised reed he will not break. A smoldering wick he will not quench. He's the one we read of in Revelation this morning. who knocks on the door and wants to eat with you, who wants fellowship with you. He's not a harsh taskmaster. He's not someone who barks at you and shouts at you. He's a kind, gentle, sympathetic, heavenly master. I wonder, have you lost sight, perhaps, of the beauty of Jesus? If so, you need to linger here in Isaiah's words quoted by Matthew. Look at the Pharisees. Look at them. And then thank God that our master is not one of them. And he's not like them. He's different. Thou hast the true and perfect gentleness, we say. No harshness hast thou, and no bitterness. O grant to us the grace we find in you, that we may dwell in perfect unity. Jesus has a beauty the Pharisees can't match. So Jesus has a significance the Pharisees don't understand. Jesus has a beauty the Pharisees can't match. And then thirdly and finally, Jesus has a destiny the Pharisees won't alter. Jesus has a destiny the Pharisees won't alter. So look at that chilling verse, verse 14. Jesus has healed this man in the synagogue. The Pharisees went out and conspired against him how to destroy him. And verses 15 and 16 then are a response to that. Jesus, aware of this, aware that they were out to destroy him, withdrew from there. Many followed him. He healed them. He ordered them not to make him known. We have those kinds of commands from time to time. And I think they need to be interpreted on a case-by-case basis. And in this case, the reason that Jesus orders them not to make him known is because he's withdrawn from the Pharisees who are out to kill him. And it's then that Matthew says in verse 17, this was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. Which raises the question, well, which bit? I mean, it's a long quotation from Isaiah. Which bit of the quotation fulfills what Matthew has just told us? Well, verse 18, behold my servant whom I have chosen, etc. That doesn't really fit as the fulfillment. Most people think it's verses 19 and 20 that are being fulfilled. So he will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. Well, Jesus is now withdrawn from the streets. He's withdrawn to hide from the Pharisees, so no one's hearing his voice in the streets. So that must be what Matthew says, what Matthew means when he says this fulfilled Isaiah's prophecy. But there may be a grain of truth in that. However, I tend to think that verses 19 and 20 rather part of this contrast with the Pharisees that I've tried to bring out already this morning. They broke bruised reeds. Jesus doesn't break bruised reeds. They're proud and harsh. He's lowly and gentle. So I don't think verses 19 and 20 really are what Matthew is getting at. I think rather it's the very last part, the last line of verse 20 and then verse 21. It's that that's being fulfilled. Until he brings justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles will hope. What's Isaiah saying there? He's saying that Jesus has a destiny. There's something that he's going to do. There's a mission he's going to fulfill. And the point is then that if the Pharisees kill Jesus now, if they just knock him off one day, he's not going to be able to fulfill that destiny. And so Jesus withdrawing and hiding himself so that the Pharisees can't kill him, that enables him to fulfill Isaiah's prophecy and complete his destiny and bring justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles can hope. That's the logic, I think. But that just brings us then, as we close this morning, to think about what this destiny is, till he brings justice to victory. What does that mean? What was this destiny that Jesus had? Well, some think it's talking about the end and the end of the age and the new world, when justice will be perfectly done and there'll be new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. But that doesn't seem to fit the logic, because he says until he brings justice to victory and in his name the Gentiles will hope. So the justice being victorious seems to precede the Gentiles placing their hope in the Messiah. which also is what you get at the end of verse 18. He will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. So justice having been victorious, it will then be proclaimed to the Gentiles. So the order seems to be justice first, then the Gentiles put in their trust in Jesus. So what's the justice then? What's this triumph of justice? Well, surely it's the cross. It's a reference to Calvary. At Calvary, justice would be brought to victory. Because all the sins of God's people would be laid on Jesus, and they would be justly dealt with, and justice would be satisfied. We tend to think of Calvary as the triumph of mercy, don't we? The triumph of grace, the triumph of love, and of course it is all of that. But it's also, of course, the triumph of justice, where all our sins were justly dealt with and justice was satisfied. And I think we neglect that emphasis to our detriment, because it's actually a wonderful thing. It is something worth proclaiming to the Gentiles that at Calvary justice triumphed. Justice was victorious. Is it not such a wonderfully assuring emphasis for those of us who are Christians this morning? On what is my salvation based? Is it simply a merciful whim that God once had? Oh, I want to be merciful to Dan Peters. No. My salvation is based on justice having been satisfied in relation to every last sin of mine. So that even if God, and we know he won't, but even if God one day decided he didn't want me to be in heaven, after all, he couldn't undo what was done at Calvary. My sins have been answered for. Justice has been satisfied. God would be unjust now not to forgive me, not to justify me, not to admit me into heaven. That's the wonderful security that we have in the light of justice triumphing at Calvary. Our salvation, yes, it's based on the love and the grace and the mercy of God, and that won't fail. And he won't change his mind in those areas. But it's also based on the justice of God. When through grace in Christ our trust is, justice smiles and asks no more. And so it's another refutation to throw back in Satan's face, another rebuttal to throw back at Satan when he tries to make you doubt your salvation tomorrow morning. Your sins, you know, might still bring you down. No, Satan. My salvation is based on a sacrifice where justice was fully and finally and irreversibly satisfied. And if you're not a Christian this morning, you can come and believe in Jesus and trust in the cross of Calvary. And you can then say the rest of your days, my sins haven't been overlooked by God. My sins haven't been forgotten about by God. My sins haven't been just kind of set aside conveniently by God. They've been justly dealt with by God. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to say. Come to Jesus Christ. Amen.